The Thomistic Institute's Aquinas 101 program is bringing the truth of the Catholic faith to millions every year, but it's only possible because of support from listeners like you. Aquinas 101 is entirely audience-funded. Each episode exists thanks to your generosity. Will you help make the next one possible with a small gift? Visit ThomisticInstitute.org/donate to learn more. That's ThomisticInstitute.org/donate.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Nowadays, when we think about evil, disease is one of the things that comes very quickly to mind. That wasn't always the case. I mean, we all always knew that disease was a bad thing. But one of the things let's think about is, why is it that now, in modern times, disease has sort of come to the forefront of things that are evil? I mean, there are plenty of other things that are evil, wars, sometimes necessary, perhaps, said Thomas Aquinas, Saint Augustine. But why has disease in modern time come to the forefront when we talk about evil? I'm going to start with a couple of anecdotes, and then I'm going to give the first look at the problem of evil. I always have to say that it's not one version of the problem of evil. That is a fairly modern way to look at the problem of evil, that there is a single formulation that covers it all. We'll survey some of the approaches that have been taken to the problem of evil, and one in particular from Augustine, from Thomas Aquinas, which is the privative of evil, and I'll say what that means. It has very much to do with what the verb to be heard is, stated in verbs. And then, a few little bit more about the philosophy there. Then I will come to a little bit of science. That's my day job, is I work in a lab, study disease, and I teach about it to medical students for many years. And somewhere along the line, it struck me that the view of evil that you read about in Thomas Aquinas and all this really works pretty well when you think about the science of disease. What happens, science, you know, pathophysiology of disease. And I don't think we'll get to the last few topics, but you see them listed there. So let's begin. Okay, the first thing. You have this book club. Here's a book that you might want to consider reading. It is an anecdote, but not mine. Peter de Vries was a very, very popular novelist in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. And then he sort of got forgotten about for a while, like a lot of great authors that happened. That in some way rediscovers them. And I'm happy to say it was the University of Chicago Press that did that. He wrote the very witty comic novels with a serious side. But this one, I would say, is a little bit more serious than the others. And the reason is that it has to do with his daughter who died of leukemia. Now, this is the bad old days. Nowadays, there's a lot we can do for people. Immunological malignancies, but this was the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and it was much worse then. The Blood of the Lamb, you can tell from the title that he addresses the question of what kind of a God do we have that would allow a little girl to die of leukemia. Why does that happen? Why does a good and all-powerful God allow that to happen? It's one of the questions he considers there. Okay. So that's an anecdote, but not mine. Now, something that was a little bit more of my anecdote. This is when I was in medical school. Many years ago, decades ago. And there was one patient I was particularly struck with. He was a 14-year-old boy named Sylvester, and he had sickle cell anemia. And I don't mean sickle cell trait, I mean full-blown sickle cell anemia. Now, are there any biology majors here? Okay, so you may know the cause of sickle cell anemia. It is two alleles of the gene, of the beta chain. Hemoglobin has four chains, two alpha, two beta chains. And it's a point mutation. Adenosine gets mutated, and instead of encoding the normal amino acid there, which is glutamate, here's the glutamate, polar amino acid. And so the A becomes a T, and what you get instead of a glutamic acid is valine. And that changes the properties. The molecule still looks like hemoglobin, but it has kind of a greasy patch on the surface, and it makes these long chains, grease, sixth grease. And before long, you have these long chains of hemoglobin molecule, and those bend the red blood cells into this sickle shape. And then what happens is that here's a blood smear, and here's a sickle cell. And there are some other abnormalities on there we won't go into. But what happens, and most of the symptoms are due to this, these cells, sickle cells, are rigid, and they form clogs and small blood vessels. And so that gives rise to essentially all of the symptoms and all the findings of sickle cell anemia. And here are they. Here they are. There's anemia because these blood cells get wrecked. But the worst thing happens, and it happened to Sylvester, is these pain crises. When the blood cells clog the small blood vessels, especially of the bone, it hurts like crazy. And they come out, this comes into kind of crises, and it's extraordinarily painful. He had many painful crises and very severe ones. And then they gave him pain medicine, and then he developed. And he also had a symptom called dactylitis, which I have a picture of. You can see the swelling of this hand here, because the same changes that occur in the bone and cause the painful crises occur in the skin and cause it to swell like that. And then delayed growth, visual problems because blockage of retinal blood vessels, frequent infections because the spleen gets trashed. And it's all the same, you know, it's the same kind of mechanism over and over again. Many others. Sylvester also had epileptic seizures, and he had a transient paralysis. And those are things probably happening in the blood vessels of the brain. Okay, now, same question I raised about a child getting leukemia, but now we have a kind of a global problem, or a very widespread problem. Why is there this hemoglobin S gene? Well, we can give a kind of an explanation in terms of the cold, hard, and Africa situation. If you look at where the hemoglobin S allele, the sickle cell allele occurs, it's pretty close to where malaria occurs. It pretty much overlaps with the malaria belt. And it so happens that if you have one allele, you are protected, one hemoglobin S allele, you're protected from malaria. If you have two, you have this horrible disease. So you have, you know, two alleles of every gene, more or less. And so the cold, hard math of it is that there is a selective advantage to having the hemoglobin S gene, because more people will survive malaria than will die of sickle cell anemia. Now, I'm phrasing this about as coldly as possible, because when you have a guy, this is why I wanted to give a name to this patient that I knew many years ago, because you have to say, you have to ask this question, is this the best way to deal with malaria? Does God value the human being and the malaria parasite equally? What kind of a God allows this kind of thing to happen? That's the question. I mean, there are ways to answer it, and I'll get to those in a moment. I just want to mention this phenomenon where you have a heterozygote, one allele, selective advantage, two alleles, disadvantage, and on balance, that the math works out that there's a somewhat of an advantage to the population to have this allele to carry this bad gene. This is not confined to human beings. It occurs in animals, other than humans, it occurs in plants. This is one called a growth snail, and that weird banding pattern is another example of a balanced polymorphism. All right, now there's one more thing to say about the biology of sickle cell anemia, and you may have heard about this. It's one stupid nucleotide. It would sound so easy. Just fix the nucleotide. We can do things with DNA now, right? So just fix the nucleotide. Well, first of all, it's not really easy. However, it's now doable. In fact, it's being done. And what you do basically is you take the stem cells from the patient and you manipulate the DNA and you get the patient back his own stem cells and you fix the mutation in the petri dish, so to speak. Not quite so easy to do, but it is now doable. All right. So now let's come to the problem of evil that I've alluded to a few times. This is one version of the problem of evil. It's from a 5th century philosopher by the name of Boethius. If you read a lot of Thomas Aquinas, you know that after Augustine and Aristotle and Scripture, next, and there's a fourth, number four in the number of citations, is a philosopher named Dionysius. And number five is Boethius. So Thomas Aquinas quotes Boethius often. He wrote a book called On the Consolation of Philosophy. And he was a Roman statesman, senator, and he was a genuinely good man. And he was Christian. And this was a period of time in which the Roman Empire first embraced Christianity, then it rejected it, it went back and forth like a roller coaster. And unfortunately for Boethius, he got screwed politically, having to do with being a Christian. He was sent into exile and then he was executed. But while he was in exile, he wrote a book called On the Consolation of Philosophy. And he addresses a woman who was a personification of philosophy, and he asks her this question. Now, I'm only giving you the first half now for a reason. He said, if God exists, whence evil? Now, we can fill this out a little bit, and it's been done by many people. If God exists and is all good and all powerful, why is there evil in the world? Now, Boethius put it very succinctly, si deus est in de nullum, if God exists, whence evil? Where does evil come from if God exists and is all-powerful and all-good? And here is another version of the problem glory, version of the problem glory. This one is from Lucretius, who wrote On the Nature of Things, and he was quoting Epicurus and David Hume, the 18th century Scottish philosopher, for a very different reason, also quoted the same, one of these same lines from Epicurus. He says, is God willing to prevent evil, but not able? Is he both able and willing? Then whence cometh evil? Where's the evil come from? Is he neither able nor willing? Then why call him God? All right. So you see, we have quite a dilemma on our hands. And in fact, this is not a dilemma, it's a trilemma. It's a little bit like playing whack-a-mole. Defend God's power, and then you call into question his goodness. Defend God's goodness, and then you call into question his power. It's a very thorny problem. I just want to say that there are people who say we shouldn't even philosophize about this problem. And this is one by the name of Stanley Harrowes, basically says the philosophical problem has nothing to do with religion. I don't agree with him, and I don't think Thomas Aquinas did either. This is the inventor of the word theodicy, which is modern relative to, let's say, Boethius and Thomas Aquinas. He lived in the 18th century, and theodicy means justification of God on philosophical grounds. And he said he could do it, but David Hume, roughly the same time, said it wasn't possible to defend this logically. Anyway, let's move on. I don't want to spend too much time on that. I think coming to Thomas Aquinas, why philosophize is, this is something that Thomas did address. He said we shouldn't just believe blindly. Philosophy can come to our aid. He says, the apostle says, this is early on in the Summa Theologica, he says, the invisible things of him are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made. And then from St. Paul's letter to the Romans. And then Thomas adds, but this would not be unless the existence of God could be demonstrated through the things that are made. Now, let's remember that when Thomas talked about philosophy, he didn't only mean what we call philosophy. He also meant natural philosophy, which is science. It's okay, in other words, to look at the world as a reflection of God. So the invisible things of him are clearly seen from the things that are made. It's okay to look at the world and then infer things about God. Not everything. For example, he said, the Trinity is an article of faith, period. No way you can know that from natural reason, from science, for example. It's an article of faith. That's a little bit about Thomas I'll come back to. Okay, let's come back to the problem of evil, and let me give you the second half of that quote. So here it is again, if God exists, when's evil? But Boethius went on and asked this. He said, if God does not exist, whence the good? Now, why this is very important to put these two questions together is that in modern times, at least, and I think even before modern times, some people would say, well, this is an unsolvable problem. This proves that God does not exist. But saying that raises more problems than it solves. Because what does the good come from? Is it just what I like, me? That's a pretty self-centered way of looking at the universe. Where does the good come from, if not from God? You know, people will say very glibly, oh, well, human beings define it. Which human beings? And which definition from human beings is the good? It's not so easy to define the good. In fact, I don't think it's possible to define the good without some absolute like God. Okay. About Thomas Aquinas, here's another quote from Thomas Aquinas. And he did point out the centrality of the problem of evil. And this is, again, early on, question two. For those of you who have looked into the Summa, either of the Summas of Thomas, you wrote two, you know that his usual method was, we'd ask a big question, in this case, whether God exists. And then he would give a lot of objections. It would seem that God does not exist. Now, when he asks whether the soul is a body, he comes up with eight objections. Okay? And I think the record for Thomas is one question in the Summa Contra Gentilis where he comes up with something like 53 objections. All right? Now, it would sound like a bigger question whether God exists. He can come up with only two objections. And he's not cheating. There really are only two objections. I challenge anyone to come up with a third. There are a lot of reasons in human behavior why humans don't believe in God, but that's not the same thing as an argument against the existence of God. So what are the two arguments that Thomas came up with? One is, he says, well, we have this other thing called nature, and that explains everything, so we don't need a concept of God. And if you think about it, this is what some modern scientists say. God is just an explanation that people came up with before they had science. Now, I don't agree with that, obviously. I think that God is more than just a scientific explanation or an explanation that goes beyond science. God is the source of goodness, of the universe, and of life. But let's look at that first one, which is, I think, really the only, that is his argument about nature is really an argument from what's called parsimony. You have one principle, you don't need the second one. But the only real objection to the existence of God is this first one. It would seem that God does not exist because if one of two contraries be infinite, the other would be altogether destroyed. The word God means that he is infinite goodness. If, therefore, God existed, there would be no evil discoverable, but there is evil in the world. Therefore, God does not exist. That's the objection. The answer is a little harder. Okay, let's go through survey some of the approaches people have taken, and I'm giving one version of the problem of evil just as a way of thinking about the approaches people have taken to it. As I said, you can first start by saying, well, okay, God doesn't exist. So we have evil in the world because there is no God. And as I said, the problem with this, here's Samuel Beckett. This is from his play Endgame, this line. They're waiting for God and he never shows up. So they flew a disaster. He doesn't exist. And as I say, the problem then is, how do you define the source of the good? What is the source of the good if there is no God? Just human beings? Which one? The one that says the bastard, he doesn't exist? Which human being do you mean? Caligula? Emperor Nero? Which human being do you mean that defines the good? It's not a very robust solution to the problem of evil. Okay. Thomas Aquinas, Ossian, were much less worried about atheism than they were about another problem, which is called Manichaeism. And this is basically questioning God's omnipotence. And let me say a few words about Manichaeism. Manichaeism is related to polytheism in a way. But who was Mani? Mani was a Persian philosopher from the 3rd century, and he believed that in the universe there was this primordial conflict between the force of light and the force of dark. And this is a very attractive trope, okay, because that's how we experience evil. When I started out and I talked about suffering children, it's very striking. It hits us square between the eyes, okay? So Mani said, others too, he wasn't the only one, that there is a primeval conflict in the universe between the forces of light and darkness, good and evil, and they're more or less equally powerful, so they're constantly butting heads against each other, all right? And usually they associated evil with the body, and that's one of the things Augustine was for 7 years a lector, reader for the Manichaeans, but this is one of the things that he drew dislike about them. And the other thing was that they say, how do you get out of this? Well, gnosis, special knowledge, available only to the elite. And guess who are the elites? The Manichaeans themselves. So it's a very conceited religion. They have a very high opinion of themselves. And that's another reason Augustine grew to dislike them. Anyway, what I always say is, if you think that this is just some obscure 5th century, 3rd to 5th century religion, think about this, the force of light and the force of dark. Why is it that we think of good and evil in these terms? It's a very natural thing, because this is the way the human mind is constructed. The human mind thinks of things in terms of oppositions, opposites, hot and cold, light and dark. Now, if I ask you, any physics majors here? If I ask you, what is darkness? You don't have to be a physics major to know this. It's not that there are dark particles and light particles. It's just there aren't very many photons around. That's what darkness is. If I ask you what cold is, it's not a lot of molecular motion. It's not that there are hot particles and cold particles. All right? Much the same way, the fact that we think of it in terms of opposites doesn't mean that there's a force of good and a force of evil. All right? But anyway, Manichaeism is one approach people take it to problem evil. Now, the other thing, as I mentioned, you know, this is this game of whack-a-mole. You can defend God's omnipotence. He's all-powerful, but that calls into question his goodness. And a lot of I mentioned the word theodicy. The people who wrote theodicy were very concerned with God's goodness. How can he allow this to occur if he's all powerful? And my second favorite novel, Brothers Karamazov, one of the characters, Ivan Karamazov, this is the question he always raises. He returns the ticket to God because he doesn't want to have anything to do with the world that God created with so much suffering in it. He says that God is worshipped only for his power, not for his goodness, not for being just, not for being loving, just for his power. Okay, that's Dostoevsky. And I'm going to... and here's the question. Ivan Karamazov, his brother, is a novice in the local monastery. Ivan assaults him pretty much verbally. Tell me straight out, I call on you, answer me. Imagine that you yourself are building the edifice of human destiny with the object of making people happy. That's where we read, right? In the finale, and I'm giving the peace and rest at last, but for that you must inevitably and unavoidably torture just one tiny creature. That same child who Ivan had described, who was beating your chest with a little fist, and raise your edifice on the foundation of her unrequited tears. Would you agree to be the architect in such conditions? Tell me the truth. And of course, poor Alyosha, What's he going to say? Yeah, let the child suffer. No, he's not going to say that, obviously. Okay. I'll skip ataraxia in the interest of time and just come to this one, is you can deny that there's such a thing as evil. And this is to deny moral categories. So nihilists do that. And then there are people who are biologists and scientists. And it's not just that they're scientists that say that science and biology is the only source of knowledge about the world and the living world. So it's biologism and scientism. All right? So this, I use this, it's kind of an awkward word, but someone who is a believer in biologism is not a biologist. I mean, I'm a biologist, but it's a biologismist. Someone who believes that everything about life can be understood through biology. Everything about the world can be understood through science. And so, for example, what I said about sickle cell anemia before, and the malaria belt, and balanced polymorphisms, someone who believes that biologism would say, don't bring good and evil into it. It has nothing to do with anything. All right? So that's biologism and nihilism. And Dostoevsky was very anti-nihilism, but this is the guy whose name is most associated with nihilism, and here's a quote from him. To be fair, it's posthumous, book that it was published after he died. He said, what I am going to relate is the history of the next 2 centuries. I shall describe what will happen, what must necessarily happen, the triumph of nihilism. And so we'll cease to believe in good and evil as categories. It's just power, 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 power. Grabbing power, doing what you want, human-defined goodness. All right. So, at long last, we come to Thomas Aquinas and what he said about evil, how he thought about the problem of evil. And that has to do with this word is. If God and the word exists, if God exists and is omnipotent, is good, is why is there evil? What does the word is mean? What does this state be verb mean? Do we need them? Immanuel Kant said, no, we don't really need them at all. But I don't agree with that, and I'm going to quote Augustine, Thomas Aquinas on that. This is a great moment in Augustine's Confessions when he's worried constantly about where does evil come. How can God allow evil to occur? And he has this great insight. Seems to understand everything about evil. The Manichaeans couldn't help him. After the Manichaeans, he went with the Platonists for a while. They couldn't help him. And now he has this insight. And I want to spend a little time on this because it's critical. He said, in Book 8 of Confessions, 7, and it was made clear to me that those things are good which yet are corrupted, which neither were they supremely good, nor unless they were good, could be corrupted. Let's just take that so far. If they weren't good, there would be nothing to corrupt in them. So evil can only occur in something that's good. Very important point. But it's also not supremely good, because supremely good means it can't be corrupted. And then he goes on to say, because if it was supremely good, it would be incorruptible. And if not good at all, there was nothing in it to corrupt. Okay, now, so in other words, evil can occur, but only in this sort of middle level. Not zero good, not supremely good, just whatever is in the middle. All right? And now, here is where he gets into trouble unfairly, but people call him out for it. And I'm going to defend him. Not that he needs to defend him, but he says, So long, therefore, as they are good. In other words, anything that has being has goodness. Let's say emphatically what he was not saying. Everything in the world is just fine and dandy and hunky-dory. No, that's not what he was saying. What he was saying is that to be good, it must exist. What exists has goodness. It is made by God. It was whatever is good. But he does not mean, and I'm going to come back to this point, because we have to say when we mean part of this word is, are these two the same? Whatever is good. That evil then which I sought whence it was is not any substance. For if it were a substance, it would be good. Okay, now, this is getting to the privative view of evil. What is evil in the view of Thomas Aquinas and Augustine? It is privation. All right? Let's consider two things that cannot see. A blind person and a stone. In which case is it an evil? I'm not saying, you know, when you talk about disabilities, you always have to add that sometimes disability has a good side to it. That's what disability activists are always pointing out. But, you know, let's say you have eyesight and you get a disease of the eyes and now you lose eyesight and you're very upset about it. Okay, now, so in the human being, that's a bad thing. In the stone, it's not bad. Why not? Because the stone never had sight to begin with. The evil is the loss of a good, not the mere absence of a good. All right? So blindness in a stone is a mere absence. Thomas Aquinas said it was a negation, not a privation. Whereas blindness in a human being is a privation because it's the loss of sight. Right? So, we're going to come to this word is. And you're reading the Summa Theologica, which is the book Thomas was writing when he stopped writing and he died not long thereafter. Never completed it, as you probably know. Never completed the third part of the supplement. But this is from his first book, which is called On Being in Essence. And this is something he points out. He says, the word is, the word exists, the word in the state of being verb, it's really two verbs, two words at once. If I say the sky is blue, what do I mean by that? What I mean by that is not that the sky is the color of blue itself. No, what I mean is that the sky has the quality of blue color. So that is what he called a metacognitive. It takes the idea of sky and the idea of blueness and links them together. The sky is blue. On the other hand, this word composites something in reality. If I say God is love, I mean God is love. That is the reality of God. Now, obviously, an atheist can disagree with that statement, but the statement is God is love, and what is meant by it is that God is love. This is positing something in reality. God is love. God is the creator of the world. All right? This is not a quality that God has. That is what God is. So, two different words. Now, there's one more thing I have to say philosophically before coming back to disease a little bit, and that is that what a thing is called its essence. All right? And I think next I have, my good friend the dog here. Now, if I ask you, what is a dog? I mean, after you say you're an idiot, you don't know what a dog is. What you might say is, a dog is a four-legged animal with hair and a wagon tail and a wet nose. And then I show you this cutie, and I say, oh, then that's not a dog. Of course it's a dog, right? the fact that it has only three legs doesn't stop it from being a dog. All right, now suppose I have an animal, a dog, or an animal that was bred not to have hair. There are dogs like that. They've been bred not to have hair because the hair causes allergies, and some people who are very allergic and have dogs, they get one of these hairless dogs. So anything that I say about the dog, it can be there or not there. Four legs, wet nose, wagging tail. Suppose the dog is sick and unhappy. Nose won't be wet. The nose will be dry. Tail won't be wagging. And yet it'll still be a dog. Why? What goes on? Okay, so what goes on here is that this is something from Aristotle and from Thomas Aquinas, essences and accidents. A dog is something with a doggy essence. Now, the problem is that we can't observe essences. We can only observe accidents. Four legs, that's an accident. All right? Wet nose, wagging tail, hair, those are all accidents. Now, if you think about what scientists do, they collect accidents that occur commonly. If you collect DNA sequences, you're looking for a particular kind of accident that is usually there, like the four legs of a dog. All right? Dogs usually have four legs. They don't absolutely have to, but they usually have four legs. That is what is called a propria. Usually, but not always present. Four legs, wet nose, wagging tail, particular DNA sequence. Those are all propria. An accident, maybe it's there, maybe it's not. Doesn't matter. But what defines the dog is the doggy essence. And Aristotle said, Thomas Aquinas said, we do not observe essences, only accidents. We have only fur. Okay, last few points here. I don't know how far we'll get, but I mentioned that when you think about the primitive view of evil, that it is the loss of a good quality. I think that applies very directly to disease. Health is kind of like dogginess. It's an essence that you can't observe or define directly. You have to infer it. But disease is the privation of health. And I want to illustrate that a little bit. So evil is the privation of the good. We've talked about that. And I've also mentioned this, but I think it's worth seeing coming back to it. Evil is neither a being nor a good. And Thomas says, one opposite is known through the other, is darkness is known. So like, I didn't make that up, he did. Or he didn't even, Aristotle did. But goodness and good and evil are known through each other. That doesn't mean that's on the level of knowledge, but on the level of being. That doesn't mean that good and evil have equal ontological status. Okay, so Thomas, let me say one more thing about disease. And Thomas defined, divided evil into two things. One is culpa, which means simply fault or sin, and culpa is fault in Latin. And if you have free will, you're capable of sinning. If you don't have free will, you're not capable of sinning. All right. This is something that, interestingly, a lot of different philosophers of very, very different characters have agreed upon. Immanuel Kant said that. Thomas Aquinas said that. No free will, no morality. Got to have free will to have morality. If you're just a machine, morality is not, there's no such thing as morality. Okay. So that's culpa. Voluntary things are capable of fault. And then the other is where disease fits in, and that's called pina. And the interesting thing about pina, the word pina in Latin, is that it can be translated as either pain or punishment. And it suggests an interesting link between those two things, pain and punishment. But Thomas said that pina is the evil which comes from the withdrawal of the form and integrity of the thing. So if you think of a whole, healthy human being, the loss of that form and integrity is what a disease is. Okay. So I'm going to illustrate this with one big set of diseases, cancer. This is a cancer of the lung, that white stuff. And by the way, that black stuff in the white stuff is carbon pigment because this person was a smoker. It does not come from living in Chicago or Atlanta. I can tell you I've seen lungs of people who lived in Chicago for 90 years, and their lungs are nice and pink when they die if they didn't smoke. So that black pigment is from smoking. And this person is a kind of carbon cancer that is strongly associated with smoking called squamous carcinoma. And this is what it looks like under the microscope. These are squamous cells that are dividing willy-nilly. All right, so cancer, we use words to describe cancer like invasive, all right? It's aggressive, evasive, invasive. And yet, that is caused by the loss of functions. Okay, so what causes cancer? The accumulation of non-lethal mutations. And these are the most important ones. But basically, you lose the genes that control cell growth. You get mutations in the genes that control cell growth. They're called proto-oncogenes, tumor suppressor gene, genes of apoptosis, DNA repair genes. You get mutations, those genes that encode proteins don't get made or don't work, and that's what causes cancer. That's sort of the 25-word edition of it. If you want to read more, you can consult this book that has it in about 500 very dense pages, but very good dense pages, where you get chapter and verse of all these mutations. But it's the loss of function. And it gets really confusing in biology because biologists have this term called gain of function mutation. What it means is that you make a lot of a protein. So it looks like there's a gain of protein. Or that really is a loss of regulation. You know, think about cell growth. You're not supposed to grow and grow and grow and grow. Normal growth of a tissue is you grow up to a boundary of an organ, and then you stop. That's normal growth. Abnormal growth is the loss of that regulation. Okay, so, I mean, I think we don't need to belabor this point, and we're getting out of time, so I'm just going to move on. I guess we do have a couple of minutes to talk about. How long do we go? Okay, I'll say just a couple of words about originals. Which is sort of a separate topic, but obviously related. Because I mentioned before that there's this oddity in Latin, and it's not just Latin, obviously, that the word pina can be translated as either pain or punishment. So is disease a punishment from God? Is it a punishment from God? And this is a quote from St. Paul's letter to the Romans, he said, therefore, just as sin entered the world through one man as death through sin, and in this way, death came to all people because all sin. So that's what St. Paul had to say, one of the things. But there are problems here. And let me come back to Ivan Karamazov. Augustine said that child does not baptize, dies, that child cannot go to heaven. Now, there's been a lot made of that, but that's not true at all Christian churches. And so here again from Brothers Karamazov, Ivan Karamazov is talking, and he was raised in the Russian Orthodox Church, the Eastern Church. And so he says to his brother Alyosha, he said, "I will not speak of grown-ups, because apart from the fact that they are disgusting, not a very Christian view of grown-ups, I don't think, and do not deserve love, they also have retribution. They need paid back. They ate the apple, and they knew good and evil, and became as gods, and they still go on eating. But little children have not eaten anything and are not yet guilty of anything." Now, that is contrary to some of the things that Augustine said. And it is the view of the Russian Orthodox and the Greek Orthodox and other Orthodox churches that children are not born with original sin. They become sinful as they enter the world and adopt bad habits. Okay, let me say what Thomas had to say, Thomas Aquinas. And as usual, Thomas has some brilliant things to say about this. He said he made a distinction. He said Adam and Eve sinned. That's the original sin. But what we inherit is not the sin. It's a disposition. It's very similar to what Iran says. He says actual sin is inordinateness of an act, whereas original sin, being the sin of nature, is an inordinate disposition of nature. We have a tendency to go that way, and has the character of fault through being transmitted from our first parents, as stated above. And so he says that original sin is a habit, and habit is, in Latin, it's habitus, it really means more what we would, I think the word disposition is probably a better translation than word. We have this disposition to go wrong. And I want to add with one point, which is about the relationship between suffering in this world and a particular person's sin. And for that, I go back to the book of Job. And you know what happened in the book of Job. Poor Job was a blameless and upright man. And it's not who said that, God said it. Direct from God. "Blameless have you not seen my servant Job, who is blameless and upright." And so Satan says, "Well, the only reason he obeys you is because you're powerful. Make him suffer and see if he still obeys you." And of course, in the first two chapters, he did. So say he went forth from the presence of the Lord and afflicted Job with loathsome sores in the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. That's only one of the many things he did. Well, most give him a bad disease. But he did a lot of terrible things to Job and his family. And then, that's chapter 2, Job is steadfast. But in chapter 3, he's anything but steadfast. And chapter 3 begins, "And then Job cursed his day," meaning his birthday, the day of his birth. Well, that's pretty blasphemous, you know. You're not supposed to do that. So then the three friends come, and as I like to say, I prefer to call them interlocutors, because with friends like that, who needs enemies? They come along, and this is one of the three friends, Eliphaz. I mentioned the name because I'm going to give you a quote from Thomas Aquinas, not Eliphaz. And Eliphaz says, "Well, if you're suffering, you must have sinned. Think now, who that was innocent ever perished?" And of course, this is rather contrary to how we think about things. We think a lot of innocent people perish. I certainly think a lot of innocent people perish. And so Thomas Aquinas, one of his books, very fine book, but you know, less read, is literal exposition of the book of Job, where he goes line by line. And comments on the book of Job. And this is what he said. He said, if it were true, as Eliphaz was trying to claim, that friend that I just quoted, that the proper punishment of sins were the adversities of the present life, it would follow that men would suffer grave adversities because of grave sins and light adversities because of light sins. And so just men would never be subjected to grave adversities, which is patently false. I mean, that's the point. Temporal adversity, as he goes on to say, is not the proper punishment for sins, and the discussion in the whole book, E.E. Job, will generally concern this point. And so Thomas Aquinas agrees with God that Job really is blameless and upright and doesn't deserve the sufferings that he has. And I'm going to stop at this point just because we're out of time. There's a lot more to say. I talk here about elephants and other animals and where morality comes from. And I think I will simply... I like to end on this point. This is a woman by the name of Augustine, who was the patient at Alamos Alzheimer, studied first while she was alive, and then they looked at her brain after she died. And he did not name the disease after himself. The disease was named after him by another prominent neurologist, Ingo Kraepelin, after Alzheimer died. But this is a picture of Augustine. And I like to, I think of this as her as having a forlorn expression. She doesn't know where she is. She doesn't know how long she's been there. And I'd like to say about this picture that we will be judged as a society, not by how we treat the strong, but by how we treat women like Augusta D. And that's it. Happy to talk and give discussion.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.